From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. The O.J. Simpson trial has turned America into a country of amateur forensic scientists. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with one of America's leading forensic pathologists, Dr. Michael Bodden. He's investigated the JFK assassination, the Klaus von Bülow case, and he's currently working on the Simpson case. Also, we feature a 1993 interview with Morgan Freeman. He's now starring in the new film, The Shawshank Redemption. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, Ed Wood, about the notoriously bad film director. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Reports from the Pentagon say President Clinton has dispatched an aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf in response to Iraqi troop movements near the Kuwaiti border. U.S. Army troops are also on alert. President Clinton says he won't let Baghdad try to push the United Nations into lifting economic sanctions.
Iraq should not be able to intimidate the United Nations Security Council and the U.N. mission there. They should not be misled into thinking that they can repeat the mistakes of the past. If Iraq really is trying to say in some insistent way that what they want is relief from the UN sanctions, there is a clear way for them to achieve that relief. Simply comply with the United Nations resolutions.
The USS George Washington has reportedly been told to move from the Adriatic Sea to the Red Sea. Its aircraft can apparently strike Iraq from that distance if they're ordered to. Great Britain has also dispatched a frigate to the Persian Gulf to keep an eye on Iraqi movement. Earlier today, Iraqi Deputy Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz denounced the UN sanctions on his country and demanded they be lifted. UN Ambassador Madeleine Albright was not impressed by his speech.
Iraq has miscalculated before about the resolve of the international community. It is very important for them not to make that miscalculation again and to question at all the resolve of the international community with regards to this issue.
Iraq has responded by saying no one has the right to interfere in its internal military movements. An official statement released today neither confirms nor denies that Iraqi troops are moving toward the Kuwaiti border. Thousands of Haitians marched through Port-au-Prince today, calling for military leader Raul Cedras to leave power. They also demanded the immediate return of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Haitian soldiers stood by when not too long ago they would have been violently breaking up the march. The United Nations is dropping all claims that Bosnian government troops mutilated bodies of 20 Serbs outside Sarajevo. The Muslim-led government denies they were mutilated, as a UN official claimed yesterday. The change has prompted the Bosnian Serbs to accuse the UN of favoring the Bosnian government. Leader Radovan Karadzic is threatening to force United Nations troops out of the 70% of Bosnia he controls. The United Nations is pressing ahead anyway. Relief flights are supposed to resume today. They have been suspended for 2 weeks. The UN had stopped them after the Serbs hinted they would attack the planes. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials have risen more than 17 points to 3,792. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is up 5.5 points at 749. This is NPR. Legislation on school lunches is headed for President Clinton's desk. The measure gives school lunch planners flexibility on ways to cut fat from menus. The bill was approved by the Senate early today. The Agriculture Department had proposed a scientific analysis system to make sure that schools cut fat and increase fruits and vegetables. But lobbyists for the planners insist this would be complicated and expensive. NASA scientists say an ozone hole has formed once again over Antarctica. This year's hole covers an area as large as North America. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
The ozone hole is an annual occurrence over Antarctica. It was first noticed by a team of British observers in 1985 and has been seen every year since during the Antarctic spring. According to satellite measurements, the area of ozone now extends for 9 million square miles. That makes this year's hole about the same as last year, but not quite as big as the one that formed 2 years ago. At 9.4 million square miles, the 92 ozone hole was the largest ever seen. Scientists believe the hole is caused largely by man-made chemicals that are used in refrigerants and aerosol can propellants. Scientists are hoping that international agreements restricting the production of ozone-depleting chemicals will ultimately shrink the size of the ozone hole in the coming years. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
Swiss police say they have issued arrest warrants for doomsday cult leader Luc Jouret and his assistant Joseph DiMembro. A Swiss investigative judge says Jouret visited his chalet in Switzerland hours before some cult members died there. The judge says that Jouret had to get a locksmith to let him into the building. The chalet and three other buildings went up in flames overnight. 48 members of the Order of the Solar Tradition were found dead in the rubble. Another investigator says evidence now shows some of the victims were executed. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If the O.J. Simpson trial has inspired you to learn more about forensics, we've got the guest for you. Dr. Michael Bodden is a forensic pathologist, a medical examiner who performs autopsies on people who have died unnatural or mysterious deaths. Dr. Bodden is co-director of the Forensic Sciences Unit for the New York State Police. He also investigates cases as a consultant to the FBI. He consulted on the investigations into the Kennedy and King assassinations and worked on the cases of Klaus von Bülow, Tawana Brawley, John Belushi, and the World Trade Center bombing. He's now working with the Simpson defense team. Dr. Bodden is the author of a 1989 memoir called Unnatural Death. Before we hear the interview we recorded last January, let me warn you that his descriptions of his work are sometimes pretty graphic. I asked what kinds of bodies he examines.
There are over 2 million deaths a year in this country. It works out about 92% of all deaths are natural deaths, cancer, heart disease, stroke. And those bodies usually are attended to by the treating physician, and death certificates are issued. When death is unnatural, in those 8% of cases, homicide, suicide, accident, they're referred for investigation to the medical examiner or coroner and for determination of cause of death.
Now, as you point out in your book, a medical examiner can not only determine the cause of death in an unnatural death, but the medical examiner becomes an early warning system in identifying new diseases and other problems in society. What kinds of things?
We see any new drug that comes in, with designer drugs, if a new form of LSD or a new form of a narcotic drug comes into the community, we often are the first to identify the drug by finding it in dead people on chemical analysis. We find patterns of disease. If there's suddenly an increase in heart disease deaths in a certain group, as has been found in cocaine users, we can call that to public attention. If somebody comes from another country and dies of a potentially contagious disease, we're the ones who have to identify that disease, as people coming from foreign countries through Kennedy Airport, where we found that a number of times.
Let's talk a little bit about the autopsy process. When you're looking at a body, I imagine the first thing you do is just look at it before you even open it up. What are some of the things,
Terry,
that you can...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Even before what you say, to do a proper medical legal investigation of an unnatural death, the first part of it is going to the scene where the body is.
Oh, you go there.
That's correct. In a proper investigation, there's a tremendous amount of information at the scene of death. When I get called on a case that require, or any medical exam that requires medical exam investigation, going to the scene to find out how long a body has been dead, to find out if there are any hairs or fibers or semen or saliva on the body that have to be identified and protected, is critical. Once the body is brought to the autopsy table, and if the first time I see that body is on the autopsy table, I've already lost a lot of the scientific information that might be useful in the further investigation of the death.
What can you tell by just looking at a dead body? How can you tell by looking at it how long it's been dead?
The body's been dead, we can tell by testing for the changes that occur if the body dies. It's amazing Terry, we go through life, and if we cut ourselves, we always have red blood coming out.
Mm-hmm.
But about 45% of our blood is solid, is red cells and white cells. And we don't appreciate that. In addition to the heart pumping the blood all around the body, it also churns the blood up. When we give blood in a blood bank, you can see readily how about half the plastic bag fills up with red stuff at the bottom and yellow fluid on the top. That's how the blood normally would separate out. And the reason it doesn't separate out like that in our bodies is because of the churning action of the heart. Once the heart stops beating, the blood stops getting churned up, the red cells start settling down just as it would in a blood bank, and it takes time to discolor the body. Within a few hours, the lower portions of the body have this maroon discolored look caused by the settling red cells, and that gives us an idea of how long somebody's been dead. It tells us if the body's been moved after death or not. So that by looking at the body, one can tell if the person's freshly dead or has been dead 12 hours or in between. In addition to that, we have the stiffness of the body. Even, you know, Quincy and Poirot would go to that, is you can feel the joints and feel how the muscle tightens up because it's not getting the waste products taken away that the blood usually does, and as the urea and the other things build up, the muscles stiffen, and that tells us an idea of how long somebody's been dead, and also the temperature change.
There's a lot that the stomach can tell you when you're doing an autopsy. What could it tell you?
How digestion proceeds, and I like to refer to paraphrase Professor Einstein, that God does not play dice with digestion. When we eat something, the digestion proceeds in an orderly manner. Most meals will be processed by the stomach in less than 2 hours. So if we eat something at breakfast at 8 o'clock, most of 95% of what we've eaten will have been processed and pushed out of the stomach into the small intestine by 10 o'clock in the morning. If we find somebody who has a stomach full of food, it would indicate that person had died less than 2 hours. Also, the stomach contents give us an idea as to what the person ate. If the person ate steak or carrots or vegetables, those materials can be identified in the stomach, and we can determine whether or not the person ate the last known meal or went out someplace else and ate a meal. Sometimes this becomes very important in establishing whether a person's information alibi is correct. When a person dies can become a very important aspect of an investigation.
One stomach revelation that helps solve the case, there's a story in one of your cases, in which within the stomach there was pretty much a raw French fry, an undigested French fry, and the French fry had a very distinctive cut to it. And by looking at that cut, one of the police on the case recognized the diner that this person must have eaten in, and that basically helped solve the whole mystery.
Yeah, I think, and he taught me something. It's amazing when the police come to autopsies and district attorneys come to the autopsy, how we learn from each other. In this particular case you're referring to, after I looked at the stomach contents and I said, look, it looks like this young lady had died less than an hour or two after eating. So if you find who her boyfriend was and whom she ate with, there's a good chance that he's involved in the death. He looked at the material and said, Doc, I can do you one better, because the nature, the way that French fry was cut was not the usual McDonald's fast food restaurant, but was done in a way that a certain diner that the police officer would eat at recognized, and that's what solved the crime. And he was able on that basis to find out who this unidentified woman was, and to solve the crime.
He was able to go to the diner, give him a picture of the dead woman. They recognized the dead woman at the diner and knew who she had her last meal with.
Absolutely, yeah. And that is how our leads can help. But it's a mutual process. And I think with the you know, what's happened, when I started out in this field in the 1960s, most homicides were solved by confessions.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, confessions don't have the same weight as they used to for various reasons, some very good. But there's also been a burgeoning of scientific evidence that's independent material that can tell what happened without the confession. And unless the doctors doing the autopsies know how to do to read the body. You said how we look at a body, we read, we talk with the dead body from our experience. Unless there are doctors trained to do this, the homicide resolution rate, accountability, is going to diminish even further. Why would people stop killing other people if, for example, there was no reasonable chance they were going to get caught? It has to be shown that if somebody commits a homicide, there's a reasonable chance he's going to be caught and brought to justice and go to jail. Less than half of all murderers in this country spend any jail time. And part of that is because we're not using the forensic evidence, the scientific evidence, the stomach contents evidence, etc.
Do you think of yourself as part detective, part doctor?
I think of myself as part detective, but not in the Quincy sense. You see, my concern is not who done it. My concern is what happened. I'm a detective in how people die and what kind of evidence they leave behind. Whenever two people come into contact, each leaves something of the other on the other individual.
What, like a hair, a fiber?
Hairs, fibers, semen, blood. In order for a perpetrator to get into a house, he's got to walk over. He's got to walk. There's often shoe prints, tire prints. All this evidence becomes important in identifying who was there, who did what to whom. Getting the clothing of the suspect is important, as well as getting the clothing of the decedent, because there's a transfer of information. We shake hands. We transfer bacteria. Occasionally, bacteria have been used to solve crimes. So there's a lot of scientific evidence that can be used that replaces much more fairly the confession. But most jurisdictions lose the value of solving cases by confession and have not had the ability to use the scientific evidence. We have more than a dozen states in this country that don't have a single forensic pathologist, single medical examiner who's trained in this area in the whole state.
My guest is forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Bodden. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Michael Bodden, medical examiner. He's director of New York State's Forensic Sciences Unit, and he consults to the FBI. Now, you headed the forensic pathology investigation for the 1977 Congressional Commission on Assassinations. You reviewed the evidence in the John F. Kennedy assassination, and you believe that it was a single bullet.
Yeah, well, there were two bullets, but one of them was the so-called magic bullet that Oliver Stone doesn't like. Clearly, in reviewing President Kennedy's autopsy, lots of mistakes were made in that autopsy. It was a poorly done autopsy by forensic standards, by medical examiner standards. But the bottom line, two rifle wounds from behind, from the area where Oswald was, and only two bullets struck the president from behind. One, the single bullet, went through, exited the president's neck, and then struck Governor Connally and went through Governor Connally and was found on a stretcher in Parkland Hospital. There's no magic about it. That bullet went in the normal straight pattern that bullets go in. That was our conclusion. You know, just a sadness that anybody looking at the Zapruder film would have known immediately that the president died of this bullet wound of the head, and there was a second bullet wound that struck him in the back. The cause of death wasn't what was important with President Kennedy. It was all the attendant information, which was an entrance wound at autopsy, what was an exit wound, much of which was done poorly. And it is, I thought, and we members of the committee 30 years ago, thought this would be a wake-up call to the country that this death of President Kennedy is a reflection on the poor ability that this country has to investigate murders, because doctors don't know the difference in entrance wounds and exit wounds normally, as with President Kennedy. But instead, the country and Oliver Stone and all the critics seized upon the errors as being unique, that the only reason there were mistakes made was because there's a cover-up on the president. In actual fact, it was the usual way that autopsies were done 30 years ago by untrained pathologist in forensic pathology. And sadly, it is the same type of autopsies that's going on today.
Now, I know that you're working on the Joel Rifkin case, the case of a serial killer in Long Island. Were you in on identifying that several murders were the work of one killer?
In part. My role in Joel Rifkin is part of the New York State Police Forensic Sciences Unit, and it's just an odd situation where an alert New York State police trooper stopping a car that didn't have proper license plates noticed from odor that there was a decomposing body in the car, spoke to Rifkin, and Rifkin said, I've killed 17 people. We did not know there was a serial murderer out there killing these prostitutes until he confessed to it. And that's, again, part of the deficiencies we have in death investigation. These deaths occurred over many different counties in New York and maybe New Jersey. And when the bodies were found, many of these bodies were not called homicides. They were called cocaine overdose. They were called drowning. And it's just a sadness with Joel Rifkin that when the police rely on the medical examiner or coroner to investigate a death, and if the medical examiner or coroner misses that it's a homicide, the police have no idea that they're looking for a serial murderer. So with Joel Rifkin, again, it's a message to us that we've got to get our act together. And when autopsies are done and people are murdered, if we don't identify them, they're going to repeat those murders. And that's happening more and more. There are more serial murders now. For whatever reason, people can move better nowadays. And unless we stop a serial murder after one or two or three deaths, a string of them are going to happen afterwards. But in the the role of the New York State Police was in part to work with the different counties to confirm the identification of who these people were and to establish the cause of death. And in fact, these causes of death were suffocation or strangulation, not drowning or cocaine overdose.
What does it do to you psychologically to be working so much with the dead?
That's a frequent question that medical examiners are asked. When we see the dead body, they're out of their misery. It isn't the dead who are in pain. It's the people who are dying. And it's the relatives of people who are dead. But doing autopsies, going into an autopsy room where there may be a half a dozen people who were alive yesterday, who are dead today, isn't as upsetting as going into a cancer ward in a hospital with people, to me, where people are dying gradually from their illnesses. But we know when we go to the autopsy table and somebody has died of alcohol or drugs or a poorly designed automobile, when we didn't have seatbelts, our job is to learn from the dead. This is a tradition among all pathologists. How do we learn from the dead to help the living? And in that sense, it isn't as depressing as it sounds. We also work with living victims. Seeing the living battered child is more depressing to me, to look at the marks and the injuries and say, no, this couldn't have happened in the innocent way the mother says it happened. Somebody intentionally beat up the child. That's much more depressing to me than finding a dead baby who's already out of his or her misery. Because I know when I say to the police, this child was battered, it's not innocent, the difficulties there are still in protecting the child from its hostile environment. We're not set up to provide proper rearing of children who are being beaten up.
You said that you like to learn from the dead how to help the living. Is there an example of that you can give us?
Well, I think seatbelts are very important. When I started out as a medical examiner, we used to see deaths of passengers and drivers with their necks cut through by the glass on the windshield. There were no restraint systems. Babies used to be impaled on ornaments and radio knobs that would stick out of the dashboard. Because of work that medical examiners have done in defining that people die from the secondary impact injury has helped lead to better restraint systems, to safety glass on the windows, to dashboards that aren't hazards when somebody gets into an accident, even to seat belts. So I think the whole area of automobile safety has greatly benefited from the findings that medical examiners have made at autopsy.
Does your line of work make you worry more about violent death, about becoming a victim?
Not so much about becoming a victim. And it's amazing, Terry, when you say, when you get up and testify in court and you see the bad guys as defendants, do you get worried about retribution? Absolutely not. Never have I heard in this country, except on Perry Mason, of the bad guy taking out the outcome of being found guilty on the medical examiner. I sort of have the feeling that we're both professionals. He's there listening to see how well I got it. I always have the feeling after I testify, I want to go up to the defendant if he's guilty or whatever and say, did I get it right? Where could I learn from how the blows were occurred? But there's no danger that way. I think that clearly we see the casualness which people are killed in this country. And it's just mind-boggling how life doesn't mean what it used to mean when I was growing up, when I was a kid. People, and this has lots of problems involved, but one of the problems that has to be addressed is you got to find out who done it. And the only way you're going to find out who done it is if you have better medical examiners to start off as to find out what happened and how it happened. And that isn't being done.
Dr. Michael Bodden is a forensic pathologist. He co-directs the Forensic Sciences Unit for the New York State Police, and he's now working with the Simpson Defense Team. Our interview was recorded last January. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up from the archives, an interview with actor Morgan Freeman. He's now starring in the film The Shawshank Redemption. His other films include Unforgiven, Driving Miss Daisy, Glory, Robin Hood, Lean on Me, and Street Smart. And there's a new movie about one of the most inept directors in film history. Stephen Schiff reviews Ed Wood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Haitian senators have now approved part of an amnesty agreement for the nation's military leaders. The idea is to help push General Raoul Cedras from power. NPR's David Wellner, who's in Port-au-Prince, says the vote has a political effect.
That means it only applies to those acts considered related to the coup d'etat that overthrew President Aristide 3 years ago. Presumably, all members of the military who were involved in those acts would be covered by the amnesty, but the many other crimes, such as rape and torture and murder, that have occurred in the 3 years since then would not be covered. It will be up to the courts to decide which ones will be and which ones won't.
Many Haitian lawmakers had to leave hiding to debate and pass this measure. Both the U.S. House and Senate say American troops should leave Haiti as soon as possible, but both chambers have approved resolutions without deadlines for the troops to leave. The votes came after hours of arguments on President Clinton's Haiti policy. Republicans spoke against the presence of U.S. troops in that country, and Democrats warned that imposing a deadline could endanger the lives of American troops. House Majority Leader Dick Gephardt says Congress has never before renounced a military operation underway. But Republican leader Bob Michaels says the administration's Haiti policy doesn't make any sense. Swiss police have issued arrest warrants for cult leader Luc Jouret in the wake of this week's deaths of 53 of his followers on two continents. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Police in Grange-sur-Salvin, where 25 people were found in three burnt-out chalets owned by Jouret, acted after their investigations showed the cult leader and his right-hand man, Joseph de Mambro, had called a locksmith to open the buildings hours before the fire started. It's not clear whether the two men died with their followers. The police are certain that some of the dead were murdered. 20 of the Swiss victims were found with bullet wounds in the head, and investigators claim the wounds could not have been self-inflicted. Investigating judge André Piller said there was certainly another person who put bullets into the heads of several victims. Piller also said he had seen cult documents that showed there was a dispute between members and the leadership over money. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The government reports fewer Americans were out of work in September. The unemployment rate fell to 5.9% last month. That's the lowest jobless rate in 4 years. But the news isn't all that good. The jobless rate is probably going to make some investors more jittery. They fear strong economic growth will speed up inflation and lower the value of what they have. The Labor Department says 239,000 new jobs have been created. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 22 points today to close at 3,797. Advancing issues led declines by a 4-3 margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Romania's former king, Michael, arrived in his country today on an Air France jet. He was not allowed to enter Romania. The 72-year-old king tried to visit 2 years ago and was also forced out. He was greeted on his last brief trip by hundreds of thousands of supporters, stunning the leftist government. President Ion Iliescu has refused to even acknowledge Michael as a Romanian, calling him a foreign citizen. King Michael was stripped of his citizenship and forced to abdicate in 1947. The head of the Khmer Rouge is calling on all Cambodians to rise up and overthrow the current government. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
While the Khmer Rouge have never stopped fighting, even after signing a UN-sponsored peace accord 3 years ago, they now seem to have dropped any pretense of wanting to peacefully negotiate their way into power. In a radio broadcast today, they boasted that they just liberated six villages near the ancient temple Angkor Wat, And in a radio address yesterday, nominal leader Khieu Samphan called upon peasants throughout Cambodia to rise up and overthrow what he called the two-headed Yuen government. Yuen is a derogatory term for Vietnamese. The Khmer Rouge have a special hatred for Vietnam, which occupied Cambodia for 11 years. Its invasion ended the Khmer Rouge's Killing Fields reign in the late 1970s, during which some 1 million people died. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Bangkok.
Researchers say the shuttle Endeavour's look at Earth is showing an alarming increase in air pollution. One of the researchers says initial tests show a rise in carbon monoxide in the southern hemisphere over the last decade. Scientist Henry Reichel says the pollution comes from extensive burning of grassland and forests. He says the atmosphere has lost some of its ability to clean itself. The shuttle's radar is scanning South American and Mongolian mountain ranges. Geologists are gathering three-dimensional images of about 600 sites. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Morgan Freeman is a great actor. Critics and audiences agree. He's now starring in The Shawshank Redemption, and he also starred in Glory, Driving Miss Daisy, Unforgiven, and Lean on Me. But he didn't have a major screen role until 1980, when he was 50 years old. The film was Street Smart. Pauline Kael began her review of the movie by asking the question, is Morgan Freeman the greatest American actor? A lot of other people seem to be asking the same question. He received an Academy Award nomination and a New York Film Critics Circle Award. I spoke with Freeman last year and asked him about his role in Street Smart. He played a pimp. Kathy Baker played a prostitute who works for him. This could have been another stereotype pimp role, but Freeman transformed the part into a powerful character study. I asked if he realized the part had such potential.
You know, you read a script and you're looking at the character that you're going to be playing and thinking how much difficulty or fun it's going to be. And when I read this, this guy was really fun for an actor because he was mercurial, you know? A character that you can play who has all these different shadings to go through, that's the actor's forte. That's his métier. That's what he wants to get into, and that's where you can chew, you know?
Can you give us a sense of what you felt you could do to make sure that this wasn't just a central casting type pimp role? You know what I mean? Like when you thought about the role and what you wanted to do?
Well, after they told me I was going to be doing the role, I spoke to the costume designer, Joan Asensio, and I said I don't want anything like crushed velvet or big collars or high heels or no. I want Saks Fifth Avenue.
Well, why?
Huh?
Why did you want Saks and not Superfly?
Because I didn't want to play this kind of stereotyped guy. I once met a pimp in Chicago, and he was, he might not have been a pimp, I'll take that back, but he was definitely a well-connected procurer. Okay? And I thought, now this is the guy. This is the character you want, you know? A guy who looks good, dresses well, presents himself well, is laid back, mixes in any crowd, and has a power. There's an aura around him that turns everybody on.
Now, also in your role, you had this incredible viciousness that would just come out from out of nowhere, and it would be real scary when it did. I mean, there's this great scene where Kathy Baker, who plays a prostitute, where you think that she's betrayed you, so you take a knife and you tell her
scissors.
I'm sorry, it's a scissors. That's right, and you tell her,
I'm going to take one of your eyes.
Yeah.
You just tell me which one you want to lose. Yeah.
And then you say the right,
the left. Which, yeah. And, you know, the power of that scene is the fact that Kathy believed me. So she was she was having to deal with making that choice. It was an extraordinary scene, but it was primarily because you were watching this woman's reaction. Yeah.
I'm interested in your background. You were born in Memphis, grew up in Mississippi for the first few years of your life.
Yeah.
Raised until you were six by your grandmother.
My paternal grandmother, yeah.
Your paternal grandmother. Yeah. Where were your parents?
They were in Chicago. And when my paternal grandmother died, my biological father came down and got me and my sister. I have two brothers who were living with my maternal grandmother at the time. So, you know, we all wound up in Chicago there for a short while.
So when you went to live with your mother in Chicago, did you feel welcome? Did you feel that she wanted you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was life as it should be. Yeah.
Had she not had the money to raise you before? Or?
Well, you know, my whole background all the way back as far as I can count is Mississippi. And going from Mississippi to Chicago, Detroit, New York, you name whatever urban center migrants go to, you get in on the bottom rung. Mm-hmm. So it's better not to be burdened with your young if you can leave them home and safe in some place, you know?
So what was it like for you when you got to Chicago?
Dreadful. Just awful. It was the middle of the winter. I was not prepared in any kind of way to deal with. I mean, I came from Charleston, Mississippi. I mean, a little town where everybody, you know, the Africans have a saying, it takes a whole village to raise a child.
Yeah.
Well, I came from a situation where the whole village was raising me. And I wound up in a place where people don't even speak and they live in the same building. So it was a wrench. It was awful for a kid, 6 years old, and, you know, protected all his life.
Was it a very tough neighborhood?
Tough neighborhood. Couldn't go out, got on the street, couldn't get to school. I went to school and quit after about a week.
Because you were afraid?
Oh, it was too awful. You had to run a gauntlet just to get from home to. At the time, I lived a block from school. I couldn't make it.
So how'd you learn to defend yourself?
Well, after a period of time, you know, you see the do or die. You know, you can't just stay locked up in the house. You got to go out and face it, you know. And it's an amazing thing, too. You know, as a kid, you go out and you face the ones who grabbed you and threw you down and stuffed snow down your clothes or beat you up and sent you home. You come back out and you face them and they all laugh, you know.
Were you really tall as a kid?
No, I was very small and skinny. And
I can't imagine you short.
Well, don't think short. Think skinny.
Right. Okay. I can imagine you're skinny. That's easy.
Yeah. I was very bookish, you know, and I read all the time and was one of those strange kids.
What did you like to read?
Everything. Didn't really matter. If it was a book, I read it. I read Black Beauty, my first book when I was 8 years old. You know, I'm a hardback book instead of a comic book.
Is reading bad for your image if you have to try to prove that you can defend yourself and that you could be...
No. Reading is never bad for your image on any level at all. What's bad for your image is not being able to stand up and fight in a situation, you know. Mm-hmm. That's really bad for your image. Right. You know, particularly in any urban setting, yeah. You know. Or I suppose any place. You got to be able to defend yourself on some level or other.
So did you join a gang or anything?
Oh, yeah. When some point we moved and up to 45th and South Parkway, and I had to... Well, you do that for self-protection, you know. If you're on this turf, you're in this gang, and then you can move around. But if you go to another set of, you know, the other section of town, then woe be unto you.
Did you ever get into the kind of trouble that could have ruined your life?
Well, I was certainly headed for it. Being in these little gangs and things, you have to sort of prove yourself to someone. It's generally someone who calls himself a leader, you know. So I remember once I stole a guy's bicycle from in front of a store. You know, the other guy said, "We'll wait here. You go get the bicycle, and you meet us around the corner." All right, fine. And I went and I got the bicycle, and of course the guy came out of the store and saw me on the street with his bicycle. Snatched it away from me, grabbed me by the collar, gave me one slap, and it just happened that a grown-up was coming by at the time and told him to leave me alone. I got free of that and was gone. But, you know, the lesson in this is I'm going to do wrong. I'm going to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
So I managed somehow or other to avoid a lot of the trouble that I should have gotten into being with this gang because I knew that if I did it, they were going to catch me, and I was going to pay.
We're featuring a 1993 interview with actor Morgan Freeman. He's now starring in The Shawshank Redemption. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with Morgan Freeman. Now, you went into the Air Force.
Air Force, yeah.
Did you think about going to college?
I thought about it for a hot minute. I was in Mississippi at the time, and I knew that, I was sort of, you would call me a big fish in a little barrel at the time, because I had a good acting reputation out of high school, and I was offered partial scholarships in dramatics to go to Jackson State or Tougaloo. But I was really tired of school. I really wanted to get out and do some living, you know, and have some adventures and be a fighter pilot, you know, do all the stuff I'd seen in the movies.
Did the Air Force give you what you were hoping for?
No. It gave me what I needed, but not what I thought I was hoping for.
So what did you need and what were you hoping for?
I thought I was hoping for a white scarf and...
I've seen that movie.
Right. And wings. An F-86 jet all my own, you know. But what it gave me was a sense of confidence and discipline and an entree to the world, you know, that sort of segue from dependency on community and school and family to being able to stand on my own and really come out and meet the world. And it also got me from Mississippi to Hollywood.
How did it get you to Hollywood?
Well, when I was discharged, I was in San Bernardino.
Oh.
It's a short hop, skip, and a jump, you know, a 45, 50-minute bus ride.
Now, how did you start auditioning or getting more training or whatever when you got to Hollywood?
Well, my first thought was, I've got to get somewhere. I got to go and get a job, you know. So I went to Paramount offices up on Sunset Boulevard, and I walked in and said, you know, my name is Morgan Freeman, and I'm an actor, and I'm looking for work. And the lady gave me this card to fill out and said, you know, what kind of office machines do you operate, and how many words do you type a minute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and what's your job history? And I just graduated. I just got discharged from the service, and I don't do any of this kind of work. I'm an actor. Well, I didn't go far. I didn't get very far. And so by, I don't know, this was in February. By May, I managed to get a job as a transcript clerk at community college there, Los Angeles Community College, and enrolled in acting classes there. Yeah. I never did really get to auditions and things like that in Hollywood. I left Los Angeles the year after that and went to New York.
And worked on the stage?
No. I just came to New York to see if I couldn't find work on stage and all. You know, you come out from nowhere and you don't know how to, where to, who to. You just keep running after, you know, partially closed doors. You see somebody disappear through a door, you go running after them, and the door closes just as you get there. That sort of always happened. I went to the Negro Actors Guild on 42nd Street, and I climbed up these steps, and there was this guy sitting there, and there were all these sort of faded posters and things. And the whole thing could tell you that nothing's going on here. Nothing. You don't know about agents. You don't know about casting agents. You don't know how to... So you get a job, you know. I got a job as a telegrapher, and I stayed there until February, in the dead of winter, and then I decided to leave and went to San Francisco because I was going to leave the country ultimately and go to Paris. Heck with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't seen San Francisco, and so I went to San Francisco and managed, after a few months, to wind up in a little theater repertory company there. And that was my beginning. And from that, I got into dance. I started dancing and taking dance classes and stuff. And I stayed there until 1963 and left in September. And I came back to New York as a dancer.
What kind of dance? Broadway?
Yeah, right. Ballet, jazz, tap, all the stuff that Broadway dancers have to take.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my intro into the theater, because the most incredible and effective networking is among dancers.
Do you think that there are any advantages and disadvantages of having really made it as an actor, of really getting the kudos and the attention and the roles when you reach the age of 50 as opposed to when you were still in your 20s?
I think if I had really hit it in my 20s, I would have burned out. I would have drugged myself right into oblivion. You know, I don't think I would have had enough discipline, enough smarts to control it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you start making money and getting a lot of press, I think you need either someone around you who has a head much leveler than yours, or you need some age and experience. You know, something to make you know that this is all really here today and gone tomorrow. You know, it's transitory.
That's your attitude?
Yeah, it's my attitude. I bought a boat. If it all goes to hell, I set sail.
It's like the Noel Coward song, Sail Away.
Yeah.
So is that what you do when things are going bad? You get on your boat?
No. I do that. Things are never going bad.
Uh-huh.
They are never going bad.
Morgan Freeman, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it was a pleasure.
Morgan Freeman is now starring in The Shawshank Redemption. Our interview was recorded last year. We'll bring out more interviews from the archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Well, once again, Saddam Hussein is moving troops toward Kuwait. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. It's difficult to know exactly what's going on. Iraq has moved several thousand troops, apparently, down toward the border with Kuwait. Trevor Rowe has a report from the United Nations. President Clinton, in response, has ordered a U.S. Navy carrier to be sent to the Persian Gulf to add to the fleet there. Britain is sending a naval frigate to the area. I'll speak with an editor in Jordan who says that Iraq's economy continues to suffer. This could be seen as a distracting move. In other stories, Melissa Block reports on the governor's race in New York, and Pam Houston on the technicalities of the movie The River Wild.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critics have been applauding Tim Burton ever since he made Pee-wee's Big Adventure in 1985, and the applause grew louder when he went on to direct Beetlejuice, the two Batman movies, Edward Scissorhands, and last year's Nightmare Before Christmas. Now he's made a movie about a man who's been dubbed the worst movie director of all time. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Ed Wood.
At the heart of Burton's new movie is an artist's primal fear. What if you create something, put all your feeling and intelligence into it, and then everyone thinks it's absolutely awful? The trouble with Burton's film is that the answer it supplies is much less interesting than that question. According to Ed Wood, the movie, you don't learn, you don't change, you don't even despair. You just keep smiling and believing and making your appalling pictures one after another. Edward D. Wood, Jr. has become a cult figure, best remembered for writing and directing Glenn or Glenda in 1953, and Plan 9 from Outer Space in 1959. But if those were merely the worst movies ever made, as they've often been called, he wouldn't be remembered at all. When you see them today, Wood's films are certainly inept, but they're not just inept. They're strangely thoughtful, intense, and sincere. Plan 9 from Outer Space is much more watchable than, say, Melanie Griffith's last five movies. There's a sensibility behind it, a hazy vision of beauty and coherence that Wood's stunted talent could never articulate, all of which makes it oddly poignant and disturbing. Burton's movie, unfortunately, is neither, but even though it goes nowhere, and slowly at that, It is evocative, expertly made, and sometimes very, very funny. Johnny Depp plays Ed Wood with a John Waters mustache and a boomingly false stage voice that often makes him sound like John Lovitz. His Ed Wood is nothing if not dogged, and Depp conveys his dim bulb enthusiasm almost too proficiently. In this scene, for instance, Wood's backers have the misfortune of actually watching him direct a shot from the movie they're financing.
And cut! Print! We're moving on! That was perfect.
Perfect? Mr. Wood, do you know anything about the art of film production?
Well, I like to think so.
That cardboard headstone tipped over, this graveyard is obviously phony.
Nobody will ever notice that. Filmmaking is not about the tiny details. It's about the big picture.
The big picture?
Yes.
Then how about when the policeman arrived in daylight, but now it's suddenly night?
What do you know? Haven't you heard of suspension of disbelief?
Tim Burton has never known much about storytelling, but his mastery of atmosphere has never failed him either. And he's filmed Ed Wood in a stark black and white that conjures up every 50s grade Z movie ever made, right down to the cheesy furniture and looming shadows. He also conjures up a certain freakish social milieu, the Hollywood fringe society of has-beens and never-will-bes, best represented here by Jeffrey Jones as the TV psychic Criswell, Bill Murray as the would-be transsexual Bunny Breckenridge, and especially Martin Landau. Landau is magnificent as Wood's idol and star, Bela Lugosi, who died after shooting two scenes in Plan 9 from Outer Space and was replaced by a young chiropractor, who spent the whole picture skulking around with his face hidden behind his cape. In the end, Ed Wood the movie is amusing, but it leaves an odd taste in your mouth, because it keeps congratulating its hero for triumphing over adversity, even though his films stink. In other words, the message Tim Burton delivers is actually the same sorry message mainstream Hollywood has been quietly sending for years, which is, it doesn't matter whether a movie's worth making. What counts is getting it made.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Bob Alls, Chris Fraley, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Yeah, the devil knows him, Mama! Bootzilla's here!
On the next Fresh Air, the space-age funk of Bootsy Collins. Before forming his own rubber band, he backed up James Brown and George Clinton. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Funk and life to play with. Yeah. What?